Next speaker is Professor John Sarr. He's professor of philosophy at the University of California in Berkeley. He made great contribution in philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of society. And he will speak today to us about the truth and post-truth. Thank you.
Bon, heureusement pour vous, j'ai pas l'habitude de donner des conférences en français et ainsi je vais donner une conférence en anglais, hein, ou pour parler un peu plus exact, en américain, ok? Ça va aller si je parle en anglais. J'espère que j'ai l'impression que tout le monde parle en anglais ici, heureusement pour n'importe qui. Ok, I'm going to talk about a number of issues and let me say at the beginning, we are not in an era of post-truth. The whole idea is, for reasons I will explain, idiotic. You could not be in an era of post-truth if you have language at all, because one of the functions of language is to commit you to the truth. That's the definition of an assertion. I'll come back to that point. So we're not in an era of post-truth. The idea is idiotic, and I will try to explain why the notion of a speech act, the sorts of things I am performing now, those already in certain kinds commit you to truth. However, given this brilliant audience, I cannot resist posing a number of questions about issues that puzzle me. Now, one of the things that happened in the past election is we were totally astounded. And we were let down by the establishment of deep thinkers who write for the New York Times and lecture in universities like Berkeley and Harvard and so on. Nobody predicted what actually happened. And there were all of these extremely sophisticated sampling techniques that showed Hillary was going to win the election. And those of us on the West Coast went to bed at night thinking, well, okay, Hillary's going to win the election. And then we woke up in a different world. And here's an amazing fact. Nobody takes responsibility. Nobody says, I was totally wrong. Everybody says, well, you know, all these other guys, they all made these stupid mistakes. Okay, what happened? What's going on? In any given era, it's extremely difficult to figure out what's going on. But here are some of the things that are going on. The United States, like other Western democracies, is run by a loosely defined a set of cultures and subcultures that is sometimes misleadingly called the establishment. And in the United States, as in France or other countries, there are certain sets of views that are more or less definitive of being a member of the establishment. You accept, roughly speaking, the version of physics and chemistry that you were taught in high school. You think in a world that is effectively you live in a world that's effectively described by physics. You might think, well, what's the role of religion in this establishment view? It's very interesting. Religion in the United States has become a private matter. There are lots of religious people and lots of non-religious people, but it's not a source of public debate. In the first half of the 20th century and for most of the 19th century, religion was very much a subject of public debate, and there were famous religious people who were trying to convert all the rest of us and so on, and even some famous anti-religious people. But by and large, religion is not a major source of debate. There is a worldview, and I won't tell you the details of it, but there's a worldview that's accepted by the members of the establishment. Now, what happened is we discovered there are a lot of people that don't share that worldview. There are a lot of people for whom it is not simply ridiculous to say Bill and Hillary Clinton are poisoning our water supply. You know, I think that is too ridiculous to be worth discussing. But it turns out methods there are for discovering public opinion, there are a sizable number of people who believe something like that, who believe absolutely ridiculous propositions. And suddenly, they emerged as a political force. You mustn't exaggerate. It wasn't an overwhelming election, but we were all taken by surprise. Now, it's a mistake to take literally the things that are being said. Trump's right about that. Hillary Clinton gave a speech in the coal country where she said, "The coal industry in the United States is finished." And all of her audience applauded vigorously. Donald Trump gave a speech in the same region in which he said, "I am going to revive the coal industry, and you're all going to get your jobs back in the coal mines." Big applause. Now, what is a mistake is to think that his audience believed that. They didn't believe that he is going to revive the coal industry. They're not that stupid. It's not going to happen. But what they heard him say was, "I care about you." And the problem with Hillary Clinton and people like us is we don't care about the people in the coal industry. They got the message, and now we're going to live with that message for some years. Now, intellectuals love to exaggerate the extent of the catastrophes that have been imposed on them. I think Trump's election is not nearly as important as people maintain. Why? Well, it turned out the founding fathers did a good job. They were very concerned that somebody like Trump might win the election. They were extremely suspicious of democracy. And it's important to remind ourselves that for intellectuals in the 18th century, and indeed until fairly recently, the word democracy was an extremely suspect notion. The rule of Demos, I mean, quelle horreur, I mean, you can't imagine much worse than the rule of Demos. So they made sure, or they tried to make sure, that became a system of checks and balances. The sheer inertial force of American government is enough to paralyze anybody. What happens to people when they go to work in Washington, I did once, is it's a bit like a bullet hitting water. You are the bullet, and then you're confronted with the whole sheer inertial power of the American government. And this is why I don't think Trump is going to do very much, because it turns out you still have to get things through both houses of Congress, and you've got to then get them past the Supreme Court and so on. So far, Trump has not been able to do much. Now, there is in Europe a tendency to apply the wrong categories to the United States. Trump is not a fascist, whatever may be true of him. It's not at all like European fascism. And indeed, one of the great advantages of our present situation is he's not at all like Hitler or Mussolini. He has no horrible agenda that he wants to impose. On the contrary, he's not a super intelligent opportunist who tends to work from day to day. And I am extremely pleased that the inertial force of the American political system has so far effectively paralyzed him. He did manage to get his appointment to the Supreme Court through, and that was a stolen appointment for reasons that you all know and I won't go into. But I am not pessimistic that the Republic will cease to exist because this dreadful man has become president. Okay, well, let us then turn to the issue of truth. Now, there are certain debates that seem to be eternal, and one idiotic debate is about relativism. Paul has written the best stuff about relativism, and I'll let him tell you what's wrong with relativism. But in any case, it doesn't work as a theory of language or as a theory of society. I knew that this was an international problem many years ago when I gave a speech in this very city, and I was opposed by a guy who said, "Ce qui est vrai pour moi, c'est vrai pour moi, and ce qui est vrai pour vous, c'est vrai pour vous." I don't know what happened to this guy. His name was Jacques Attali. Il existe toujours, Steve. C'est un politicien en ce moment-là. Il existe quand même, malheureusement. Okay, but in any case, this is a dumb view, and I need to say some things about truth. So I'm going to do straightforward, boring analytic philosophy. And those of you who don't like analytic philosophy can just go to sleep for a few minutes. There are certain propositions that appear to be inconsistent about truth. And indeed, some people think they actually define the issues about truth. And I don't think they do. I think the statements about truth, for the most part, are a series of truisms. One is the correspondence theory of truth, and that is P is true if and only if P corresponds to a fact. Or, as some people say, if P states a fact or matches a fact. Okay, that's the correspondence theory of truth. And this is regarded by some of my students as terribly oppressive. The idea that somehow we're burdened by this horrible correspondence. But then there's another rival theory that's called disquotation that just says P is true if and only if P. And then you're supposed to put quotes around that. So the favorite example here, snow is white is true if and only if snow is white. And this is called disquotation because you disquote, you drop the quotation marks here. And these two views are supposed to be in opposition. One is a traditional, oppressive, modernist, and possibly even bourgeois, and all has all sorts of other horrible features. That's this one. And this one is liberating because this one says, truth is no big deal. It doesn't matter. Now, the first thing I want to show to you is these are, in fact, equivalent. They pretty much say the same thing. This quotation says, for any statement, that statement is true if and only if, and then you just put in a statement. Snow is white is true if and only if snow is white. Grass is green is true if and only if grass is green. Trump is president is true if and only if Trump is president. So there's no real substance to truth. It's all just a dropping of the quotation marks. This one makes it look like there's some tremendous metaphysical burden of truth, and we all have to bear that burden. Now, I want to argue, in fact, that these are really equivalent if you take them seriously. If you say that P is true if and only if P, or S is true if and only if S, there's analytic philosophers make a stupid set of mistakes about use and mention. They learned it from Frege, and they have never been, I've never bothered to publish anything about it, but I will, and I'll take it, go up in the discussion if anybody wants to talk about it. But in any case, this just says, for any statement, the statement sets a condition, and the statement is true if and only if, bang, that condition. So it looks trivial. The problem with that is that you want to be able to generalize it. You want a word for these things over here that state the conditions. So it looks like you need a word, and you can put in a word like fact, or condition, or there are various other words. But now then, P is true if and only if P blanks or stands in some relation to the fact or a truth condition. And then you need a word for that. And you say things like, well, P is true if and only if P states a fact or corresponds to a fact or matches a fact. And in true steps, you've gone from this one to this one. You need a word for these things on the right-hand side, condition, fact, state of affairs, what have you. And then you need a word for the relationship, and that makes it look as if you've got some heavy-duty metaphysical apparatus, but you don't. The correspondence theory and the disquotation theory are not, in fact, in opposition to each other. Given two very simple assumptions, they are equivalent because you can derive the correspondence theory from the disquotation theory. Okay, so I don't think that there is any a problem about our need for a substantive conception of truth. It's already implicit in disquotation. The supposedly anti-substantive conception of truth already gives us a substantive conception of truth. Why then should we take it seriously? Why then is there supposed to be an issue? Well, here's where the question about relativism comes in, and it seems terribly oppressive that we should not. Yeah, let me go back a step. Why is relativism appealing? Relativism says, what's true for me is true for me, and what's true for you is true for you. Truth is always relative. Now, that's appealing because it seems to combine a kind of romantic individualism with extreme democracy. It says, you have your truth, I have my truth. That's the democratic part. But I get to decide what's true for me. That's the individualist part. The difficulty is that the constraints of truth will not be so easily overcome, and that is, it's simply, for the most part, not up to me to decide what is true. If I decide, it's extremely oppressive to think that hydrogen atoms have only one electron. I mean, how demeaning to the poor hydrogen atom stuck with a single electron throughout history, throughout the universe. Well, that's a silly view. It's not up to us to decide the structure of the hydrogen atom. It's up to how reality is. But now, isn't much of reality up to us? Yes, it is. But you need to make a very careful distinction between those parts of the world where we construct the world, where the world is as we have intentionally constructed to be. And here I'm thinking of money and property and government and marriage, cocktail parties, summer vacations, and political parties, political organizations. All of those are, in a perfectly ordinary sense, social constructions. We make those by a set of processes. And I've tried to describe these processes. They're of some interest. We're not all that intelligent, so we have a rather limited number of processes by which we create money, property, government, universities, cocktail parties, summer vacations, and conferences on the objectivity of truth. And those, I think, are genuinely social constructions. But they make sense as social constructions precisely because there is a reality that exists independently of us, which has nothing to do with being constructed. The hydrogen atom, the elliptical orbit of the planets, and the fact that the universe is a rather large place, and indeed I'll tell you some things about how large it is, all of those are given to us prior to any of these investigations. We're very impressed by our own little solar system. We don't treat our Earth very well, but we're fond of it, and we think we're going to treat it better. So it's a good idea to remind ourselves that our little sun, our sort of suburban light and heat source, is one of 100 billion such in our galaxy. Ours is no big deal, and it's not at all unreasonable to suppose that even in our galaxy, there are probably lots of solar systems capable of supporting life. It probably doesn't look at all like life here, but in any case, it's not at all unreasonable to suppose that there will be other solar systems capable of supporting life. But you say, our galaxy, how many galaxies are there? Well, our solar system is one of 100 billion in our galaxy, and there are 100 billion galaxies. It always makes me suspicious when the damn astronomers give me these. There's too many 100 billions here, too many zeros. But anyway, the number is extremely large, and it's not at all unlikely that there are all sorts of life forms that we'll never know anything about because they exist in ways in areas of the universe that are outside our life cone, our light cone. So we are confronted with a reality of which we are a tiny little part, and we're trying to cope with our little part as best we can. But let's not have an exaggerated conception of our overall magnitude in the universe as it exists, because we are a rather small fragment of this universe. But within our little world, our world as we describe it, we need to make a sharp distinction between those features of reality that are totally independent of us. Hydrogen atoms, the structure of the solar system, the existence of other galaxies, all of those are totally independent of us. And then we may need to recognize the existence of a whole lot of creations that we make. Of, as I mentioned, money and government, universities, conferences on philosophical issues. All of those are social creations. Now comes some massive confusions in our intellectual culture. And one of the worst confusion is that there is a systematic ambiguity over the notions of objectivity and subjectivity. This is a big deal in our culture. And we strive for objectivity, but the problem is that the notions are systematically ambiguous between an epistemic sense and an ontological sense. I'm sorry to use big words, but it's not unknown in French and German philosophy. These have both an epistemic, where epistemic means has to do with knowledge, and an ontological sense, where ontology means having to do with existence. In the epistemic sense, the distinction between objectivity and subjectivity is between different types of claims. If I say that Van Gogh died in France, that is epistemically objective. You can settle that as a matter of fact. But if I say Van Gogh was a much better painter than Manet, well, that's a matter of opinion. I think it's an opinion I would defend, but it's not epistemically objective. That's epistemically subjective. Everybody got that objective-subjective distinction. You need a notion of the epistemic sense of this difference. But underlying that is an ontological sense. There are many features of the universe that have an existence which is totally independent of our experiences. They are ontologically objective. And I'm thinking of mountains and molecules and tectonic plates. All of them have an existence which is ontologically objective. But of course, there are all sorts of other features of our universe which exist only insofar as they are experienced by a human or animal subject. And there I'm thinking of things like pains and tickles and itches and feelings of various kinds. I have friends who tell me they suffer from the angst of post-industrial man under late capitalism. I don't. My friends think this is a terrible limitation on my part, but whenever I start to feel the angst of post-industrial men under late capitalism, I usually go buy a beer or something like that, and I find that it cures me rapidly. Okay, now the point is this. The point of this distinction is this. There are lots of domains that are ontologically subjective, but about which we can then make epistemically objective claims. A classic case is human consciousness. Human consciousness exists only insofar as it's experienced by a subject, so it's ontologically subjective. But of course, we can have a completely epistemically objective science of human consciousness, and indeed that's what we're trying to develop. This is of some practical importance to me. When I first got interested in consciousness, I thought, well, hell, why don't these guys solve it? It's a neurobiological problem like any other. So I went over to the medical school in San Francisco and, in effect, told these guys, what am I paying you to do? Get busy and solve the problem of consciousness. And their answer was very revealing. They said, look, on your own account, consciousness is subjective. But science, Wissenschaft, it sounds better in German, is objective, so there can't be a science of consciousness. Well, you all know that's a fallacy of ambiguity. Science is indeed epistemically objective in that the scientist tries to get truths that are independent of feeling, his feelings and attitudes, but the epistemic objectivity of the scientific process does not make it impossible to have epistemically objective statements about a domain which is ontologically subjective. And in that in fact is what I've been trying to do with my theory of social reality. As I said, money and property and government and marriage are all created by human consciousness. So they have an element of ontological subjectivity in their very existence. These things are only money because we created them as money, and we treat them as money. By the way, like all Americans, it still looks like monopoly or money to me. It doesn't look like, if you want to see what, well, I won't show you what real money looks like because I don't have enough of it. But the problem with Americans is they have this stuff that's easy to counterfeit, but we love it. And no political agency can get a radical change in American currency because Americans want their currency to look like currency, even though it's ontologically subjective. They think it has a kind of objectivity. Okay, anyway, the important part of this discussion is this. Once you take seriously the idea that one of the main functions of language is to tell us things, how things are in the world, you have a class of speech acts that are committed to representing facts in the world. They have what I call the word-to-world direction of fit, where the words up here are supposed to match the world down there. Once you recognize that as the class of speech acts, and once you recognize you can't have a language without these sorts of speech acts, then the idea that we might live in an era that is post-truth is a silly idea, because true and falsity, T or F, is precisely a measure of success or failure in achieving the word-to-world direction of fit. If I say Paris is the largest city in France, well, that's not, so to speak, up for grabs. That's either true or false as a matter of epistemically objective fact, even though the fact in question has a great deal of ontological subjectivity. So we do not live in a post-truth era. We couldn't possibly if we speak to each other at all, because it's of the essence of language that characteristically speech acts involve a commitment to truth. Now, boss, how am I doing for time? How much time have I got?
Yeah, is that enough?
Maybe that's enough. We can argue about all this. Now, let me just tell you a couple of things that I think are essential, though, to understanding how the mind works and how it relates to reality. And here, let's not be ashamed to use a Kantian jargon. Let's just say there are certain transcendental presuppositions about our relation to the world, especially through language. And one presupposition is we have to presuppose that there's a reality that exists independently of our representations of it. We can't make sense of the representations. I gave you some examples about solar systems. We can't make sense of those representations without presupposing some version of metaphysical realism. Now, that's not true for all epistemically objective claims. About money and property and government marriage, you can have a domain that's ontologically subjective about which you make objective claims. But all of that rests on the assumption that there is a reality that exists independently of our representations of it, and that representations succeed depending on whether or not they match that reality, that is to say, some version of a correspondence conception of truth is built into the very structure of the mind and language. On that cheerful thought, I'll stop. Okay, you're going to call on, or am I going to call?
Oh, you can call.
Okay, you're on.
Okay, thanks. Right, I would like to sort of challenge this last thing you said about this assumption of the reality. Go back to the electrons example that you gave.
Yeah.
So, isn't what we say about reality, isn't that validated in a sense by other people, or by the procedures that other people, or by the stories that other people tell? So in the sense, if we never ask the electron whether we never ask the hydrogen atom about its story, right? We just impose it to it. I'm being joking, but do you see what I mean at the end?
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether we're answering protagonism, relativism, man is a measurable thing. Because man has to convince each other first, and that's a huge task.
Right.
Which we fail to do.
Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have time to give you another lecture, but if I did, I would love to lecture on the horrors in Western philosophy that come from confusing epistemology with ontology. You make an epistemic point. Look, we're all people. We have to investigate. We have to agree. That's an epistemic point about how we come to conclusions. But that there exists an ontology totally independent of the epistemology, that's a basic assumption of a transcendental kind behind the entire investigation. So I agree. I mean, let's take a wonderful case. Trump, with his deep sincerity, thinks, I had the biggest inaugural crowd in human history. Now, the beauty of crowds is you can count. And the photographs are so good now, you can even count with photos. You blow it up and you can count how many people were in the crowd. So there's an epistemic way to settle this. Now, Trump then says, yeah, but what about all the people watching on television at home and so on? And then the discussion tends to go on in an unproductive way. And I agree about the epistemology. This issue, how many people watched the Trump inauguration, that may never be completely settled. Not because there is no reality, but because we don't have epistemically satisfactory methods of getting all and only those people counted. But I want to say, don't confuse the epistemology with the ontology. In my case, I was not one of the people watching Trump's inauguration. That's an epistemically objective fact about an ontologically subjective domain. I had more interesting things to watch, like the basketball championships or something like that. So, yes, you do have endless discussions of an epistemic kind, but for many areas, not all, but for many areas, there's a fact of the matter which is totally independent of the epistemology. Okay, who else? Yeah, this guy.
Mark Emmerich, I'm writing a thesis in Germany about the relationship between democracy and romanticism. And yeah. So you got me hooked when you said that there's some kind of relation between romantic idealism and extreme democracy. And I want to pose two questions. And the first one is the question, how would you relate the concept of irony to truth? Because that's a very difficult matter, and I think that romantic irony has this property that it is not just relativism or anything goes, but it also has the idea to reveal some objectivity behind language, behind subjectivity, some kind of language. So I would like to know your opinion.
Well, this is heavy-duty philosophy. But the way I could discuss such matters is relative to examples. Give me an example of how romantic irony affects ontology.
I will do this with the second question, so maybe this is a good explanation.
Yeah, okay.
Because
yeah.
What you said about the way objectivity to subjectivity and the way around, how can we get from subjective facts to some kind of objectivity, is an idea I think that Kant has proposed very good about the idea of what is an aesthetic truth or what are judgments of beauty.
Yeah.
And I think that the Romanticism takes this idea and says, okay, maybe if this the question what is beauty is maybe not just a question about art, but also a question about truth in society, and this I think what you also said. So that that would maybe be an example, but the second question was then, is there maybe a relation also between post-truth irony and the aestheticization of democracy?
And what?
Aestheticization of democracy.
Yeah. Well, I try never to talk about Kant before lunch, but in any case, here goes. I think you really cannot make sense out of the first critique unless you see it as an effort to show how you can achieve objectivity, and not just any kind of objectivity, but the objectivity of synthetic a priori propositions, how you can achieve that given idealism. Given that he accepts the idealist assumptions. Now, his solution of that is a cheat. It's called postulating the Ding on sich, There are a number of enormous disasters in the history of Western philosophy, and I'm sure you're familiar with them. Descartes, Leibniz, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, and Kant, perhaps Kant above all, because Kant thought once, in order to achieve objectivity, you have to postulate a Ding on sich, which is completely unknowable, because why? The Ding on sich provides the Grund. He's not allowed to say that because that's a word of the phenomenal world, but he did say it anyway. He said it provides the Grund of our knowledge of our objectivity of our knowledge. So that, I think, was a cheat on Kant's part. But you can see how once you've gone through Hume, remember, Hume awakened him from his dogmatic slumber by showing him that the assumptions that he made, given his Wolfian upbringing, given the upbringing and traditional German metaphysics, how he could not cope with Hume's skepticism. So he did cope by writing the Critique of Pure Reason. So I don't think the enterprise succeeds. I think it fails. But that really goes far beyond the stuff we're talking about today. The stuff we're talking about today is much more limited. Yes?
Just talking about the example of the co-worker who felt that Trump was taking care of him.
Yeah, I couldn't hear what she said.
I couldn't. Can you repeat, Chiara? Sorry.
You started with the example of the co-worker
yeah.
who felt himself protected by Trump.
Yeah. Okay, no, I think this is a serious problem for us. I think, go ahead.
My question is, how can you have an objective ontology of these? Because I'm perfectly fine with your distinction
yeah.
with epistemology and objectivity and the project, but I don't see how you can apply it on the feelings of the co-workers.
Yeah. I'm not sure I understood the question, but I'll answer it, and then you tell me how I misunderstood it. How's that? Okay. I said that one thing we discovered is that there are a whole lot of people out there who do not share our world view. Every so often I read some account about how many Republicans believe that Hillary and Bill Clinton are poisoning the water supply, and it's like a joke. Whatever they're doing, they're not poisoning the water supply. But there are a lot of people, apparently, who believe that. Now, it turns out, normally, those people are sort of not given a voice. They're given a choice between two establishment politicians, and this time, they were given a voice. Trump is their voice. And we're now going to work out the consequences of that over the next several years. But none of that is inconsistent with what I said about metaphysical realism. Yeah. What that says, there are people who do not share our worldview. They don't think the world consists of physical particles and fields of force organized into systems. They think there are all sorts of forces operating in the world, many of which are quite sinister, many of which are diabolical in the literal sense, that is, they're agents of the devil, and we have to, and they think that some other, they have to confront this, they have to confront all the sources of evil in the world. They don't accept the worldview that I take for granted. A worldview that consists of the atomic theory of matter and the Darwinian conception of biology. Now, there are a lot of people who reject the Darwinian conception of evolutionary biology. I find it hard to see how they think of the world if they don't accept something like the combination of Darwinian evolutionary theory and the atomic theory of matter. Those are the two basic assumptions behind the worldview of educated people in the present era. Now the question is, well, what's the role of religion? And the answer is, we have now domesticated religion by making it a private matter. We don't really know how deeply religious, let's say, Bill Clinton is, because it doesn't matter, because we don't care about it. Jimmy Carter was the last president to make a bore about religion. He went on and on about it. Ronald Reagan talked about religion, but nobody took him seriously. Nobody thought he believed it for a moment. He always had other things on his mind. So there are these basic metaphysical assumptions that underlie the establishment worldview. And what we discovered in this election was there are a whole lot of people who don't share those assumptions. They don't share the policy assumption that, roughly speaking, international capitalism is the best way to handle the economy. And it turned out, we thought they were benefiting from it, and they weren't. So the guy loses his job at $40 an hour in the car factory, and he gets a job at McDonald's at $15 an hour, and it's he doesn't think that he's got full employment. I mean, we found out a lot of people are very dissatisfied with the basic economic assumptions that underlie American policy. But say some more, I don't see the connection between these, roughly speaking, political, metaphysical outlooks and the denial of realism, which is implicit in a lot of relativistic theories of truth.
Is that follow-up by Professor Pogosian?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's not about any tension between us and between the politics and the metaphysics, but you just said two things in political things that seem to be sit well together. One of them was that there are lots, it turns out that there are lots of people out there who believe crazy things like Hillary's poisoning the water.
Yeah.
And they came out in this election. I mean, supposing that's true requires explanation. How did they come out in this election? Then the other thing you said is that when Donald Trump went into coal country and said that I'm going to restore the coal industry, nobody believed that because that's a crazy view.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, but that's a crazy view that matters.
No, it's a crazy view that matters a lot to them. So you'd think they'd be even more disposed to believe it, but in fact they're not disposed to believe it even according to you. So what I didn't get is this combination of them being very sensible about things that they know about and yet being prepared to. Crazy views that have nothing to do with anything.
But does that surprise you?
No, but I didn't even, I'm not seeing
what you said. Well, let me say a little bit more about it. Trump got up in front of a large number of people and said, I'm going to give you back your coal mining jobs. The coal mines are going to be put back to business again. You're all going to be making a whole lot of money as coal miners. Now, did the people who applauded vigorously actually believe that? I don't think so.
Since
I think what they heard was something much more important. This guy cares about us. Hillary Clinton doesn't care about us, but he cares about us. He will try to do something for us in a way that Democrats won't. Now, this is my reading. I could be wrong, but that's my reading of the situation. And your point is, yeah, but how can they be so shrewd about jobs in the coal mining and so confused about basic metaphysics? And the answer is, yeah, jobs in coal mining matter to them. It's a practical thing how many jobs there are in the coal mining business, and they watch the coal mining jobs decline. Whereas basic metaphysics, well, that doesn't have this kind of practical implication.
I mean, just a little quote. If I were to give an alternative explanation, is that, which is not entirely inconsistent with what you're saying, but what happened in this election is that people, especially in the places like West Virginia, which have just been going down the drain as a result of lots and lots of different factors, in particular loss of jobs, loss of community, loss of income, are so fed up with having been lied to by standard politicians for 50 years that they just sought any alternative that would out of the mainstream. That's but then they'll find out soon enough that he's a liar.
Yeah, that's not inconsistent with my view. I think we overestimate dissatisfaction with a conception that people think they've been lied to, because they always think that. I mean, I can't remember a time when large numbers of people didn't think they were being lied to by the authorities. Remember, McCarthy made his career. Europeans don't understand McCarthy. They think he was some kind of fascist. He was not. He was a populist. What he did was make his career telling people, you know, those Rockefellers, they're really communists. They're communist sympathizers. Now, the view is so preposterous that it sort of takes your breath away. I hold in my hand a list of 487 members of the Communist Party who are now in the employ of the United States State Department. Views are so preposterous that their sheer preposterousness gave them a kind of appeal.
This is time for just one last question.
There's different quality of truth, as you explained, between objectivity and subjectivity. But in your vision of a science of human conscience, the tension between objectivity and subjectivity require a new anthropology. Because the Kodal theory says we start from subjective behavior, subjective motive to objective mechanism. The iterations interactionist, say, between subjectivity, you can agree and converge on one action, one argument. But today, with the internet and different process, expansion of democracy, iteration overpass causality.
Yeah.
So your vision, your science of human consciousness, required to develop strongly, it's not only philosophy, it's a combination between objectivity and subjectivity, more larger than before.
Yeah.
What? It's supposed it's not only philosophy of logic, it's a combination of different quality of truth.
That's right. Okay. I think in order for us to develop a science of consciousness, we have to have an account of how the ontologically objective processes in the brain produce ontological subjectivity in the form of consciousness. Now, part of our problem is that our whole philosophical problem, our whole philosophical tradition makes it impossible to state the problem and the solutions. I'll give you a trivial example. I consciously decide to raise my arm and it goes up. I mean, there's no question about it. How does it work? Well, this conscious event of my trying to raise my arm is grounded in a whole lot of neurobiological processes that involve a quite specific neurotransmitter processes, and particularly acetylcholine. Acetylcholine has to be transmitted across the synaptic cleft of each damn motor neuron until it finally reaches the axon in place of the motor neurons and the arm goes up. Now, our philosophical tradition makes it impossible to say what I just said, because it looks like I'm confusing the mental and the physical. It looks like I'm describing one event, the conscious raising of my arm, and another event, the transmission of acetylcholine. I'm saying there are not two events. There's exactly one event with different descriptions. How do I know that? I know that because you can't have the one without the other. I couldn't have this conscious raising my arm without the secretion of acetylcholine and all the rest of it, and I couldn't have that particular pattern of the secretion of acetylcholine without the conscious raising of my arm. Now, the problem is that in our philosophical tradition, that looks like I'm confusing the mental and the physical. And guys attack me by saying, but there must be two causes here. There must be a physical cause and a mental cause. That's crazy. It's just, we've got to overthrow this whole tradition that says, if it's ontologically subjective, it can't be an ordinary part of the physical world. This is exactly what it is. It's an ordinary part of the physical world, whereby with the secretion of acetylcholine, I consciously raise my arm. This is another issue, and I'd love to talk about it, but it's going to be with us for a long time because we're still stuck with a 17th century vocabulary. It's a scandal the way philosophers talk about consciousness. They talk as if we didn't know anything about it. We know quite a lot about how it works in the brain. There are a whole lot of very intelligent people working on exactly this problem. And you can't help but claim that one of the dumbest views is maybe everything is conscious. This is called panpsychism. And otherwise intelligent people will tell you this sheet of paper is conscious. And this cell phone is conscious. It has a kind of boring consciousness. I wish the guy would dial more interesting numbers or something like that. But there are silly views out there, and I've been militating against them, but it's, I haven't won everything. I can tell you that. We have a long way to go.
Okay, thank you, Professor Sell.
10 minutes break.